Hello there, and welcome to episode number 10 of The Music Plays the Band. I'm your host, Rob Koritz of the Dark Star Orchestra. I'm really glad you're joining me today, and I hope you all are safe and well. Well, we have made it to 10 episodes. Who'd have thunk it? I want to thank you all for being here with me, and I want to thank my partners, the Brothers Lazaroff, for being on this journey and helping me make this happen. And now the light's getting brighter. It's April 8th right now, so 1 week from now, I will be back on the road. I'm so excited about that and working for the first time since October. And, you know, it's going to be different still. It's with drive-ins and pods and such, but I'm so excited to get back out there and play some music and entertain the fans and see some of my friends from the road. I couldn't be happier that we're getting to go out and do some work again. My featured guest today is bass virtuoso Reed Mathis. Reed might not be a household name, but if you've ever heard or seen him play with Billy and the Kids, or Mickey and Billy as the Rhythm Devils, the Jacob Fred Jazz Odyssey, Tea Leaf Green, or a host of other groups, you all know that he is just a monster player, and he exudes this just amazing positive energy when he's on stage. Also joining me is Joni Batari of the band Brown Eyed Women, which I believe is one of the only, if not the only, all-female Grateful Dead cover band in the land. Before we get started, I'd like to ask you all to support the podcast by heading over to www.patreon.com/themusicplays and purchasing a subscription. We've got tiers for everyone's budgets, and they include some great bonus content to supplement what you're hearing here on the air, and I'd love to have you along. If you'd rather make a one-time contribution, please visit paypal.me/themusicplays. You know, I couldn't do this without your support, and all the love is appreciated, so thank you very much. All right, let's get started. The Black Music Moment is brought to you by The Clean Store, brandingandapparel.com for all your branding and apparel needs. Technology-driven solutions and concierge service for managing programs of all sizes. The Black Music Moment is our attempt at chronicling the profound influence of black music and musicians on the dead. Today we honor Elizabeth Cotton. Cotton was born in 1893 to a musical family near Chapel Hill, North Carolina. She left school at age 9 to work, but saved her money and purchased her first guitar at age 12. A self-taught left-handed guitarist, Cotton developed her own original style. She played a guitar that was strung for a right-handed player, but she played it upside down, which contributed to her unusual finger-picking style. By her early teens, she was writing her own songs, one of which, Freight Train, which she wrote when she was 11, became one of her most recognized. A version recorded in 1956 by a UK group became a hit, and it's credited as one of the main influences in the rise of skiffle music, which is the music that inspired the genesis of the Beatles. At age 17, she retired from music to raise a family and didn't perform again until she was in her 60s. This came about while she was working as a housekeeper for the folk-singing Seeger family, which included their son Pete Seeger. In the 50s, the Seegers began to record her and released her songs on the Folkways label. She continued to tour and record well into her 80s, and she lived until the age of 94 when she died in 1987. Her song, Oh Babe It Ain't No Lie, debuted in the Dead's repertoire during the Warfield run in 1980, and then it was played 10 times over the course of those acoustic shows at the Warfield and Radio City Music Hall. It made a few more one-off appearances and was also performed by Garcia's side projects in numerous acoustic settings. Garcia mentioned getting Folkways albums out of the public library, and that's undoubtedly where he learned of Cotton and so many of the other black artists that the Dead would honor over the years. Cotton's version has a few different lyrics, and the order of the verses are switched, but it's still easily recognizable to Dead fans. So here is Elizabeth Cotton and her 1958 recording of Oh Babe, It Ain't No Lie.
One old woman, Lord, in this town keep her telling her lies on me. Wish till my soul that old woman would die, keep her telling her lies on me. Oh, baby, it ain't no lie. Oh, baby, it ain't no lie. Oh, baby, it ain't no lie. Life I'm living is very high. Been all around this whole round world, Lord, I just got back today. all the week, honey, and I'd give it all to you. Honey, baby, what more can I do?
The Sarno Music Solutions Breakdown with Brad Sarno is brought to you by Sarno Music Solutions, producing the finest musical instrument audio gear, designed and hand-built right here in St. Louis, Missouri since 2003, and Blue Jade Audio Mastering, St. Louis's primary mastering service since 1999. Last week, Brad and I were talking about Owsley Stanley and the Wall of Sound, and I left a little section of it out due to time constraints, and believe it or not, I had quite a few people ask this question this week. About this particular topic, so we're going to go back and give you the rest of that discussion that Brad and I had about the Wall of Sound. I'm glad you brought up Healy, because next week, in our next episode, I'd like to talk about him a little bit more. But there's one more thing I wanted to ask you about the Wall of Sound era, if you could explain it for the folks out there, because they can see it in a lot of the videos and the movie and all that. The vocalists, when they would come up, it's like two microphones.
Right.
One on top of the other.
Yeah. What that is, because the Wall of Sound was behind the microphone, behind the singers, it would have been a feedback nightmare with the sound blasting back into the microphone. So those guys were clever, and they designed these mics. It's actually two microphones, and one of the two is out of phase with the other. So what that means is it cancels everything coming from a distance. So it eliminates the feedback. And the workaround for the singer is you just sing into one of them so the singer's voice is not canceled out. And that was their solution to get a pretty good sounding vocal with no feedback.
So I guess the top mic would have been the one that was open for them to sing into then?
Well, they're both open. They could have sung into either one, but I think just ergonomically, the top one is the one that made sense.
Gotcha. And we've never seen that anywhere. No one's ever had to do that because they haven't had the PA behind them like that, correct?
Right. To my knowledge, no one's ever had that need.
How do they come up with the thoughts and figure this stuff out and think about it and come out?
Those guys are brilliant. They're from an age of engineers and electronics and radio where they were highly trained, very smart people. And like anything, you're faced with a problem and you find a solution. And the evolution of what they do is so based on solutions and necessity.
So great. And so great that we had those people, not only in the music that we love, but that they were there to kind of lay the groundwork for all live music out there.
Absolutely. Yeah. Pioneers.
Right on, man. Well, we're going to talk about the other pioneer, Dan Healy, next week, if you don't mind. So I want to thank you for your time today, and we'll get into Dan next time.
Sounds like fun.
All right, folks, that's Brad Sarno from Blue Jade Audio. Thank you, my friend.
All right, see you around, Rob.
Bye-bye. There is a Grateful Dead cover band in every town is brought to you by the Authenticity Academy, offering you online courses and private coaching. If you're feeling stuck or confused about the direction your life is going in, or you've lost touch with your authentic self, the Authenticity Academy is here to help. www.authenticity.coach. My guest today is Joni Batari, the lead guitarist for Brown Eyed Women, who, to the best of my knowledge, is the country's only all-female Dead cover band. Really cool stuff they're doing. They play really well, and this was a really enjoyable interview. All right, so I am back today with my Grateful Dead cover band segment, and with me as a guest today is Joni Batari, the lead guitarist for Brown Eyed Women. How are you today?
I'm good. How you doing, Rob?
I am so good, and I'm so glad you came on and chose to spend some time with me. I really appreciate it. Brown Eyed Women, an all-female Grateful Dead cover band who is based in all different places, if I understand right. You all don't live in the same place?
Correct. We live in six different states.
That sounds very familiar to a band that I'm a part of.
Yeah, it does.
How did you form if you all live in different states?
Well, it wasn't planned at all. somebody had called in Tales of Golden Road a couple of times, and they were like, you know, there's a lot of Grateful Dead tribute bands out there. Where are the female musicians? And I had played with David Gans at a house party in Boca maybe 9 years ago. So he would drop my name occasionally. And the last time he dropped somebody else's name, Denise Perrant from the Deadbeats in Woodstock. So I went home, my computer, and I'm like, oh, who's this other girl? What does she do? And I saw she played drums and sang and was really good. So we messaged each other, and she expressed to me that it would, you know, her dream would be to have an all-female Grateful Dead band. And I said, you know, that's a tough one. You know, and I said, however, I do know a keyboard player, Caroline Kylo, up in Boston. I'd played with her once in Florida. You know, people tend to come down to Florida to visit. And I know Dana Carroll in New Jersey, who plays with Love Light, from just chatting on the message groups. And I know Jill Simmons from The Cause in Pittsburgh, who I've done many gigs with. And I gave her the names and I said, good luck. And about a month goes by and she said, I got in touch with everybody. Everyone's interested. And then later on, someone told me about Kate Moore, who plays Bobby Parts from Atlanta. And we went from there. So it was unexpected. And yeah.
So did you all just fly somewhere and meet each other and go ahead and play and see what would happen?
Well, we were all in six different states. It was like January, I'm going to say, of 2019. And, you know, we started to have conference calls and we didn't know each other. We had no video, you know, so we've never played. We've never met. How do you book a gig? You know, if somebody wants to see you, and let alone not playing, we didn't even meet. So through my reputation and some connections with some friends down here in Florida, we booked five nights, you know, sight unseen, just on my word. And
wow, that's brave.
We all met the day before our first gig. Ooh. Had a marathon 11-hour rehearsal. And just to add a little more anxiety, or not anxiety, fun, but it was like the camera crew for the music plays, the band was there to document us meeting for the first time.
Oh, so, for the documentary.
Yeah, the documentary that Andy Logan's doing. So the camera crew was there to capture, like, hey, I'm Joni. Hey, I'm Kate. Hey, I'm, you know, Jill. So, and they stuck around and, you know, it was like a marathon rehearsal. Beforehand, we discussed, okay, we're doing the 89 version of Cassidy. Are we doing the this version of They Love Each Other? So there was a lot of prep work of what version, what year. So when we got there, we had an idea of, you know, what version.
And it all just fell into place?
I tell you, Rob, the chemistry was crazy. I mean, the chemistry was just there. The first show, I felt like I'd been playing with these girls forever.
Well, I'm sure, my God, the energy and the excitement for all of you having an opportunity. I'm going to play this music with a bunch of women for the first time, all of us together. I'm sure the energy was off the charts just walking into the room.
It was. It really was.
So cool. So very cool. You talked a little bit just a second ago about we're going to play the 89 version of this. So that kind of tells us we're going to leave this section out, or there's that extra bar here. And that kind of answers part of my question, but do you take a specific approach to interpreting and performing the music further past, okay, we're going to do the 89 version. That's really just an arrangement thing. So you're all on the same page as far as arrangements goes. Taking it a step past that, your approach to interpreting it and performing it, you're playing, I would assume you're all influenced by the players, but how do you approach it when it comes to that as a band?
That's a great question. We haven't played together a whole lot. We had done 13 shows and then the pandemic hit. So we haven't explored as much as we would have liked because the 13 shows, pandemic, all separate. So, you know, up until this point, that's a hard question to answer because we're still getting to know each other. Personally, the singers, you know, they make the songs their own. I can tell you that, you know, when Jill sings a song, you know, she definitely puts her spin on it. And when Denise sings it, she puts her spin on it.
I think it's very cool that you have a singing drummer. That is so hard.
Yes.
I could never do it. It's, first of all, my voice is terrible. But even if I had a good voice, to sing and drum at the same time, so difficult. So you'd only gotten to play 13 shows. I didn't realize that it was this new. But they were all over the place. But I mean, somewhere in Georgia, I think I saw some videos of some in Georgia.
Yeah.
And some in Florida. So how are you? And I would assume, and I see you have one booked, and I saw today that it's sold out. Congratulations.
Thank you.
How are you deciding where and when, you know, we're getting back to normal. How are you deciding where and when to play and how much you'll play? Will you tour? Will you do a weekend in one person's city, a weekend in another person's city?
Well, you know, we talk with our agent, and we're trying to hit different parts of the country, you know. So we have, we're trying to do like, this is just now, this is all subject to change, like 4 to 5 days every other month, but there's some months that they're in a row because, you know, we're not 25 and live in a van down by the river, we're all a little older. So not old, but, you know, some people have careers and whatnot, but everyone's pretty flexible and willing to jump in. So we have the Mid-Atlantic coming up in June. We sold out Baltimore today, and we have Jersey, and we decided to hit the stay outside in the summer, do only outside shows.
Smart.
Just because of what's going on in the world. So we have some shows that'll soon be announced for August in the Southeast. And we hope to hit the Northeast in the fall and some other things.
Being an all-female group, were you initially met with skepticism by the club owners or the fans or anything like that? What was the take on you all when you come out, you know? Do you think like the fans look at you all or judge you any differently because as musicians, is because it's an all-female group? That's really two questions at once. I know, I apologize, but.
Yeah, I do. I do think so. From some of the comments I read on Facebook, like, oh, I came out not expecting a whole lot, knowing that it was a girl band, but, you know, and then they would say something nice. So judging by what I see the people write, absolutely, it's, you know, there's some skepticism there.
Has it been tougher to get gigs because of it, do you think? Or do you have an agent, you said, so that helps, yeah, for sure.
Yes, we do. You know, it hasn't been tougher for us. I mean, everybody loves the idea. I mean, we were supposed to play Skull and Roses this year. So, I mean, that speaks a lot to some credibility of, you know, he really was psyched to have us. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. No, I think the club owners are like, this is different. We like them. Yeah.
And maybe some, you touched on this already, but maybe some of the fans come out at the beginning for the novelty of it, but then they hear you. I mean, I didn't know what to expect, to be completely honest. And I watched a bunch of video the other night. It's really good. So I would imagine you get a little bit of that, like you were saying on the Facebook thing, people who come out for the novelty of it and are like, holy shit, they can play. They're really, really good. I'm going to go see them again.
Right. Can you imagine if we had a few more rehearsals?
Right. Well, I can't thank you enough for being with me. I hope one of these days, we would have happened last year, our paths would have crossed. But hopefully one of these days on the road, when things are getting back to normal, our paths will cross. And I want to thank you for sharing your insight with me and wish you nothing but the best of luck moving forward.
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate it. I look forward to our paths crossing one day.
My pleasure. That's Joni Batari from Brown Eyed Women, everybody. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Rob.
If you like what you're hearing today and would like to support the podcast, I have two different ways for you to do that. You can make a one-time contribution at paypal.me/themusicplays or become a patron with a monthly subscription that includes expanded video versions of my segments, outtakes from all the interviews, some really cool community hang time, videos from home and on the road, and a lot more. So if you're interested in that, please become a patron at patreon.com/themusicplays. I thank you in advance, and any love and support is much appreciated. Our feature conversation is brought to you by Grateful Sweats. On Shakedown or online, Grateful Sweats is your first stop for subtle dead designs. Check them out at etsy.com/shop/gratefulsweats and see for yourself. Designs that only other heads will get. That shirt with the state of Tennessee and the word jet in it. Someone says nice shirt, you know that they understand what's going on here. A subtle dead cat makes its point, and no one does sweats like Grateful Sweats. Hoodies, sweatpants, joggers, tees, and much more. Subtle Dead Designs at etsy.com/shop/gratefulsweats. Today I have a conversation with Reed Mathis, one of the most accomplished and unique bass players on the scene today. Reed's firmly entrenched in the San Francisco Dead music scene, but as you will hear, he definitely did not come up in the Grateful Dead world. When I first met him way back in the early 2000s, he was playing some way out jazz with the Jacob Fred Jazz Odyssey, and his upbringing was incredibly varying from a musical standpoint. You know, I found it really interesting to talk to someone who was drawn to the Dead a little further along in his musical career. It certainly is a different and interesting perspective. This interview was actually about twice as long as what you were hearing, and it got super deep. You can hear the full version at my Patreon site, www.patreon.com/themusicplays. Okay, hello. I am here today with my friend Reed Mathis, who I believe is in San Francisco. How you doing, pal?
Hey, man. I'm doing great. You know, all things considered. I honestly couldn't ask for a much better situation in context.
Right.
How are you doing?
I'm hanging in there, you know. It's everybody's healthy, so we're good.
Yep, exactly.
You are in Frisco, right?
I mean, I'm in the Bay Area. I live in the East Bay, so I live in El Cerrito, which is a little bit north of Berkeley.
What are you doing with yourself? Keeping busy, trying to keep busy while we can't go out and play.
Honestly, this has been the most productive year of my career. I have done a ton of music making in the last year. A lot of it more on the production tip, and that stuff hasn't started to come out yet. So, but honestly, by the time this airs, probably some of that will be getting released. So I could probably talk about it. But yeah, several massive, massive projects I've seen them through to completion in the last year, and I'm super excited. My rough plan is that, you know, if the vaccine stuff goes according to schedule and next fall we're gigging, you know, I should have this like fleet of art that I'm releasing right on time for all that. So
that's awesome.
Hopefully it'll work.
So I thought that, you know, you and I go way back, but I thought this would be a really good interview and very interesting because you kind of came into this whole Grateful Dead scene, musically speaking, playing wise, after playing professionally in so many other genres and disciplines first. And from what I gather, you know, your musical upbringing was very much not Grateful Dead. So I was wondering if you could take me back to Tulsa and just give me a little synopsis about your roots, you know, in your musical life growing up in Tulsa.
Sure. One part of my musical roots was related to the Grateful Dead a lot, even though not directly, because my father, both my parents are great musicians, but when my father was a teenager in the 60s, he was a bass player in folk groups. He played upright bass and sang, and it was like mostly vocal-oriented folk groups. And so our record collection when I was little was Woody Guthrie and Cisco Houston and Lead Belly. And, you know, my parents didn't like Dylan, which is, I get it, I guess. I don't know. He's my favorite. But my parents didn't dig Dylan. So I didn't get Dylan until I was like 20. But I grew up with Woody Guthrie and Cisco Houston and that crew. So that kind of laid the groundwork for it a little bit. But my parents are classical musicians, and their fathers are classical musicians that knew each other back in the 40s and 50s,
wow,
which is how my parents met. So.
And this was all going down in Tulsa as well?
No. Tulsa came much later. I lived the first decade of my life in the Bay Area, in Menlo Park, oddly enough.
Wow.
I did not know anything about the Grateful Dead, but I grew up on Lorelei Lane right off of Marsh Road in Menlo Park. And we had these train tracks behind my house in Menlo Park where my sister and I were forbidden to go play. And of course, we went back there and played all the time. And we used to put pennies on the train tracks. So when the train came by, you know, it would turn the penny into an oval. And right. I just thought that was insanity. And years later, fast forward 35 years or something, and when I'm starting to hang out with Kreutzmann, and we're kind of doing that get to know you thing where you tell each other your backstory, and I was talking about Menlo Park, and I lived off of Marsh Road, and I was like, yeah, you know, there were these train tracks right behind my house, and Bill looked at me and goes, I put a lot of pennies on those train tracks. And I went, what? Dude, I put a lot of pennies on those train tracks. Turns out we pulled up Google Maps and the house he grew up in Palo Alto was also had those train tracks behind it, the same tracks. Wow. So we then bugged out about like, man, if either one of us had been born the same time as the other one, we would have gone to elementary school together. We would have like ridden bikes.
You would have been smashing pennies together.
Completely. So, Menlo Park, the only slightly Grateful Dead thing I remember from my childhood in Menlo Park is that my mom gave me a very stern talking to when I was probably 5 or 6, you know, when I was old enough to sort of take off on my bicycle and just go exploring without supervision. One of the warnings my mom gave me was, if a man offers you stamps, don't lick the stamps. And I remember being like, what the fuck are you talking about? What? Don't lick the stamps. And this for like forever, I was just like, that is the weirdest admonition I've ever heard. And then years and years later, when it might have been my first acid trip, one of my first acid trips in Tulsa, we had paper acid, you know, and right. And so I put this piece of paper on my tongue, and then I was like, it's kind of like a little stamp. And then suddenly my brain connected and I was like, oh shit. Menlo Park, Ken Kesey, like the whole thing, that the One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest Hospital is the Menlo Park Veterans Hospital. Like, you know, where Kesey volunteered for the acid experiments in the late 50s. I mean, the whole acid culture really started in Menlo Park. And so then I was like, oh, no wonder my mom told me not to lick stamps. She was like, a little boy licked a stamp and he thought he could fly and he jumped out a window, which terrified me as a first grader.
Right.
I lived in Menlo Park and my dad conducted choirs at the Menlo Park Presbyterian Church and was one of the associate conductors for San Francisco Opera. And we came into San Francisco, you know, on the weekends usually. I saw a lot of concerts that I didn't appreciate at the time. And in hindsight, I'm like, oh my God, I saw that, you know? Yeah. We had an awesome grand piano in the living room and my dad's cello and my dad's banjo and my dad's mandolin, and my dad's ukulele. And I was allowed to play the ukulele and the mandolin when I was little. I was not allowed to touch the cello or the banjo. And I could touch the piano, but they usually asked me to stop when I would, cause I was loud, but, the other ones I could take in my room and then they wouldn't hear it. So yeah, my relationship with music really started in my room with the door closed. And then we moved to Tulsa when I was 9, and that was super depressing. super depressing. I was not on board. And, but in hindsight, it's the best thing that could have happened, because in Tulsa, the best public schools were the magnet schools, meaning that Tulsa's really segregated, racially still to this day. And so the good schools that got all the government money that attracted the best teachers were all on the black side of town. So the best arts programs were in the black schools and they bussed white kids to that part of town. So my parents sent me to these schools and then where all the music teachers were black. So thrown into this environment that was very different than the musical environment my parents were in, basically.
I want to go jump a little forward and then we'll maybe go back again. But sure. When you and I first met, we met in 2000. Yep. And I don't know if you'll remember the day at the Mystic Hot Springs in Monroe, Utah.
That's right. You guys rolled through. Oh my God. That's fucking right.
Ah. We were either playing there after you or playing there before you, or it might've been just rolling through cause we'd already been there and we were going to play outside and you guys were indoors in that little room.
Yeah.
And we walked in there and it, absolutely. I remember Scott Larned, our former keyboard player who we miss so
Scott.
Much.
Scott, I remember. I loved Scott.
He's walking up to me on that. We're on opposite sides of the room, and him walking up to me and just going, dude, this is totally whack. And it was some of the most whacked out, yet incredibly accessible improvisation I had ever heard. We were just, I mean, this is when Brian's brother was still the drummer, I believe. This is even before Jason. Uh-huh. I mean, just jaws on the floor going, what the fuck is this? Trying to comprehend what you guys are doing. And that's 21 years ago. And everything you guys were doing was 100%, well, in my mind anyway, 100% improvised. And so different than your traditional group. You know, Brian's keeping the bass with his left hand and you're playing bass, but you're up top and playing melody essentially and different effects. At that point, how old are you?
I was probably 23.
So, and you joined JFJO before that, obviously. How old
were you? JFJO started in 94. I was a junior in high school. And that was my first band that played in front of people. Like before that, when I was in things that were called a band, it would just be like me and one other dude and we only played at our house. Right. You know, or like our big gig would be at somebody else's garage, you know? I just played music alone, you know, until I was 17. And then I got a phone call from Brian out of the blue. Brian called me up at like midnight, and was like, yo, you know, my name's Brian. And, I hear you, play bass and are you like jazz and whatever. And he was like, do you want to, would you ever be down to jam? And I was like, yeah, I'd fucking love to jam, dude. And he was like, cool. What's your address? And I told him, and he was like, I'll be there in 15 minutes. And I was like, dude, it's midnight. And he was like, well, can you swing it? And I was like, all right, sure. Let's do it. So I had to sneak out. And he took me, where did we go? We went somewhere that had a piano and played for hours, just the two of us, and was just sort of like, yeah, finally another person that's serious, you know, is what it felt like.
And you're a junior in high school when that happened?
I was a junior. Yep.
Are you or Brian, either of you, are either of you at all aware of the Grateful Dead at this point in your life?
Zero.
Zero.
Absolutely zero.
Do you remember when you first heard?
Yes. Our founding, the drummer of Jacob Fred, the original drummer, Sean Layton, his mentor was a man named Gordy Ryan, and Gordy Ryan's mentor was Babatunde Olatunji. Nice. So Gordy Ryan was in the Drums of Passion ensemble with Mickey Hart. And so I remember him pulling out Mickey's book, and kind of walking me through it a little bit. And I was like, dang. And he kind of talked about the Grateful Dead. And then, Sean's older brother, Dylan, was in Oklahoma's premier and maybe only Grateful Dead cover band, which was called Whirligig. And so starting around 95, I started sitting in with Whirligig, and, they only played Dead music. So for me to sit in, I had to learn Dead tunes, which they just taught me, like sitting there. I didn't listen to the Dead. They would just say, this one's called Eyes of the World, and it goes like this. And they would teach it to me, and then I would sit in and we would jam.
You never listened to the Dead's versions of them at that point?
Not at that point. No, I mean, wow. At that point I was 18 and I was learning so much music every day. I was like, you know, I was skipping school. I barely went to my senior year of high school. I got D's and F's and just didn't even go because I was too busy playing music all day and all night and whatever, chasing girls. But yeah, I mean, I learning a song was just sort of a normal part of my day. I was learning 10 songs a day, you know? So I would just be like, yeah, how's it go? Show it to me. You know, I liked not, there was something about There's something about not getting the full picture that really appealed to me as an improviser, because as the child of classical musicians, you know, I saw two very different approaches to music, and I very strongly rejected the classical method, which was there's a correct way and this is it. And so I, no matter what music I was learning, I always made a point to avoid the correct way. I just felt like it was the kiss of death. So yeah, when they were like, this is Friend of the Devil, this is Uncle John's Band, whatever, I would just learn it right then off of their example, as if they were original tunes of theirs, you know?
Right.
And then, cause to me it was, the improvising was the main thing. And the, you know, at that age, at least, you know, young people are trying to define themselves, and they often do it by saying what they aren't. I'm not that, I'm not that, I'm not that. So I was very much in that mode of being like, a little big for my britches and a little bit, I don't know, just sort of like I don't want to learn the right way, because that will mean I'm one of those people, and I don't want to be one of those people. I want to be one of the innovative people.
I would assume eventually you started listening to it, and
it took a long time. I remember this one night we were playing a show at the University of Oklahoma in Norman, and you know, I was a big cannabis smoker by then. I mean, acid was my first drug. But by then I was super into cannabis. And so anytime anybody was like, hey, you guys want to smoke? It was like, fuck yeah. So somebody was like, we live around the corner. You should come over, and we have a nice bong and stuff. So went over there, and I was like, what is this fucking music? Like, and they were like, oh, this is the Dead, man. This is like, whatever. And honestly, I hated it at that night. And now I realized that they were playing me probably not a great recording, you know, like, just like, definitely was not 1973. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And it was just like lots of weird synths. I just remember it being really synthy, real MIDI sounding, like all the instruments sounded kind of MIDI-ish to me. And right. I was just like, no, nope. And then, you know, it really wasn't until 2005, Steve Kimmock hired me. So by that time I was 28, and Kimmock hired me, and his driver, the driver of the RV on that tour, was Charlie Miller.
Yes, Charlie.
And
you're going to immediately hear the best sounding stuff you'll ever hear.
100%. And I was just like, bro, I'm ready. So lay it on me. It was a 6-month tour, and I just started sitting up front and being like, what's on the menu today, bro? And he would be like, this is UCLA, November 1973. And you know what I'm saying? And I was like,
there's no better way to learn about the Grateful Dead.
It was epic. I remember the first day I was like, all right, bro, we got a 12-hour drive ahead of us. Give me your number one. Give me your number one show. Let's listen to that. And he was like, fuck, that's hard. And he was like, I definitely can't give you my number one show. That's impossible. I was like, okay, give me the one you think I will like the best. Like, we knew each other okay by then. I was like, okay, give me the one you think is right for me. And he was like, boom, I can do that. He put on the Watkins Glen soundcheck. And we listened to that, and I was like, I will be fucking damned if that is not the best music I've ever heard in my life. Once Charlie kind of took me by the hand and walked me through all that, and then I asked Baracco what his favorite show was, and he told me September 72 in Jersey.
Yeah, Capitol Theater, Passaic.
Yep. Where they open with Morning Dew, and then they do basically like three sets of the greatest shit ever. So I basically started going around to all these musicians I admired and being like, what's your favorite show? And then I would listen to it 20 times, you know? And I got to a point where I was like, you could make a case for this being the best music ever made.
What grabbed you? What was the turning point when you started listening? Did you know? Do you remember?
Yes. The turning point was that they happened. It was the timing. It was the 1965 fucking timing when what the culture was doing at large at that moment. Not only the you know, Dylan plugging in and the synthesis of R&B and, you know, early rock and folk music and bluegrass music and Miles Davis and Ornette Coleman. And it was just sort of like this insane melting pot. And with this sense of the audacity to be yourself, you know, it was like, I remember Kim Ox saying when I was talking to him about it back in 05, he was like, he didn't like talking about the Dead very much. He would usually change the subject, but one time he did talk to me for a while and he was like, yeah, not a single one of those guys, with the possible exception of Garcia, are what you would call a good example of how to use their instrument. Like, they're all freaks. They all have a freakish approach to their instrument. None of them are doing the correct way. And I was like, thank you. Like, he put it so succinctly. I was like, that's what I like about them. None of them give a rat's ass what anybody thinks about their playing or their style or their feelings or the length of the song or the style of improvising or the set list. Or like, it was just like, I'd never seen a group of people outside of black jazz musicians be that fucking audacious and sure of themselves. Like, that paradox where you're so confident that you can allow yourself to be uncertain. It takes a lot of confidence to be uncertain, because humans don't like being uncertain. Playing free music, you know, what some people would call free jazz, but it's after the Grateful Dead, I don't think the word jazz belongs on that. It's just free music, you know.
Right.
Improvised stuff like Dark Star, you know. The attitude that it takes to play that, I mean, the attitude that it takes for you or me to play Dark Star for 30 minutes, that's a lot of bravery. Imagine what it was like to be the first person to do it, you know? And their fans, to be like, to stand, I mean, I know what it's like to be on stage and be improvising and get that feeling, we're losing them, we're losing the audience, you know? We've gone too far. We better do something. We better drop a funk beat to get them back. And you listen to these recordings of them playing in the early 70s, and you're just like, Jesus Christ, the cojones on these guys. To just like, I would almost get nervous listening to some of these recordings, like, oh my God, they're totally losing the audience. But they're not. For some reason, they're not. And that's what fascinated me. Like, that's what I want to learn. I want to learn the kind of teamsmanship, the kind of self-acceptance that it takes to play in that way. But the other thing is that, I'm sorry I'm talking so much. I'm drinking coffee.
No, it's great. I'm loving it. This is perfect. I'm loving it.
The other thing that was so cool about them was that they weren't like Ornette Coleman. They weren't like Miles Davis. They were comfortable in that realm, but then the next song would be Big River. Like, right. They weren't one-dimensional. And
Or in the middle, they would do a thing, I'm sure you've heard it, Dark Star for 25 minutes.
Uh-huh.
Into El Paso.
Exactly.
Back into Dark Star into the other one.
And that's where it's at. Like, that is what is, that's what makes them. I mean, you can make a case for that being some of the most incredible art ever made for that reason. Not only that reason, but the reason that it connected. Anybody can make great art and play it to five people. The fact that they were able to make great art and fill stadiums.
Let's talk about Phil for a minute. And you're a bass player. Let's talk about the bass. You know, when I look at Phil, and I'm a drummer, so I look at it through drummer's eyes, but Phil's playing is very fluid, but he's somewhat stoic and reserved a little bit in his delivery.
Mm-hmm.
And when I watch you play, you're just throwing all kinds of crazy, loose, positive energy all over the stage. Always have. Does his playing style integrate into that? Would you say his playing style, after listening to all this stuff that Charlie turned you on to, had any influence on the way you play the bass?
Oh, yeah. Extremely. not in a, what I take from other musicians is more their approach than their delivery. You know, I kind of feel like I have my own delivery, and I definitely have strong feelings, in my body that are demanding to come out, through the instrument. And that's not really something I have a lot of choice about. I've never been one of these people that I've never been like, I don't know what to write or I don't know what to play. Like I, there's always been, music kind of banging on the door to get out of me. So when I'm influenced by somebody, I rarely sound like them, but what I took from Phil, I mean, a lot of what I took from Phil, honestly, was affirmation for who I already was. I'm a bass player that every instrument should be able to play every position. Like I think of music, I think of instruments in a band in terms of like gas, liquid, solid, you know, the three states of matter on this planet. A band has all three. You're going to have something something that acts like the floor where it doesn't ever go away. It doesn't surprise you. You can basically ignore it. And then you have a liquid, which would be sort of like rhythm guitars and keyboards and stuff. And then you have foreground, which would be the singer or the soloist. And that would be the gaseous element, the thing that is completely unpredictable, constantly surprising, constantly expressive, never ignorable. So to me, those three roles, every instrument should be able to be all three roles.
I love it.
Does that make sense? Like
to me, it makes complete sense.
And so a good band will, yeah. I mean, a good band, you basically take turns. In rock and roll, people actually act like instruments are a type of person. You know what I'm saying? Like guitarists are this way. Drummers are like this. Singers are like this. Like there's so many cartoons where it's like, oh, the singer's this way and the bass player's this way. And we act like these instruments are personalities with behaviors. And
the dead was the complete opposite of that.
Exactly. Exactly. Those motherfuckers figured out how to have all of those roles be sort of blurry. Like, who's got the best rhythm in the Grateful Dead? Not the best rhythm, but the most reliable rhythm in the Grateful Dead. Arguably, Garcia. You know what I mean? I feel like when people are dancing, they're dancing to the guitar. They're dancing, mm-hmm. Especially when he's soloing, he plays so much in time. And he hits the ones and the threes so hard. And he swings, you know what I'm saying? Like the time is mostly coming from Jerry, I feel like. And Bill and Mickey are elaborating on it.
And Phil's dancing around it.
Phil's dancing around it. And the roles are all upended. And guess what? It's still fine. The music doesn't suffer. Like it's, to me, when I finally connected with the Dead and I heard that reality in there, of which Lesh is the ultimate example. He's the least traditional of any of them. And that's saying something because none of those cats are traditional use of their instrument. And I just heard that. And I suddenly realized, oh my God, these are my brothers. Like these guys are like me. Like these are also misfits.
And then down the road for you, you end up, you say, these are my brothers. They understand. I get what they're doing because it's kind of where I'm at. And then down the road, you end up playing with them.
Yeah.
would the first thing be Seven Walkers? Is that right?
Yep. Seven Walkers was the first thing.
How's that come about?
That came about through Paige McConnell, oddly enough. Every time Jacob Fred played in Burlington, Paige would come and hang out.
I saw you in Burlington just by chance. We were there on a night off and we watched the
Metronome?
No, this was at like the Flynn or the somewhere. I can't remember where, but it ended up being, it was Jason's last show.
Oh shit. No, that was at the, town hall. Yeah. Yeah. Oh my God. That was a very emotional night.
Yeah. We just happened to be in town and got to be there.
Well, Paige was a fan of the band. And then after Katrina, there was a somebody in Colorado was putting together some benefit shows to raise money to replace the public school instruments that had been damaged in the hurricane. So we were going to do a Boulder show and a Denver show, and they got Paige, and Paige got Russell Batiste and me, and Papa Molly, and that was the band. And we rehearsed for a day, and then we did these two shows, and it was super fun. And then maybe like, I guess it was like 3 years later that Papa Molly called me up and was like, hey, can you do some gigs next month? And I was like, sure. And he did, that's all he said. Can you do gigs? And I was like, yeah. And when I showed up and it was Bill, I was just like, oh, well, hi.
I had no idea what you were getting into. Seriously? You had no idea what you were going out to play?
I did not. And it wasn't called Seven Walkers. It was like, you know, Papa Molly's Swamp something. You know, and, so we did this Colorado run. And Bill and I just like, I was just like, man, you are, he was like my favorite person I had ever met. I was just like, this guy is so kind and so funny and so, like genuinely interested in me. Like I really felt seen by him. He was loving me. And I was just really, really moved by it. And this is aside from his drumming. I'm just talking about him as a man.
Right. But I'm sure that translates all of a sudden. Now I feel at peace and I feel comfortable. And we can go on stage and do whatever the hell we want. And it's going to rock.
And my style and his style surprisingly fucking matched like a motherfucker. It was like my style, my bass playing has a little more rhythm than most drummers would like. But he loved it. And my bass playing has a little more movement than most drummers would like. But he fucking loved it.
Well, that gives him more freedom as well at the same time. You know, if you have a little more rhythm than most bass players, that gives him room to move around a little bit more rhythmically.
Exactly. He's like, oh, shit. Well, if you're going to hit the two, then I can hit the and a two, you know. And it'd be like, shit, yeah. Like we started cooperating. The last day of that run, Bill was like, so would you guys be down to do this again? And we were like, hell yeah. And then he was like, so would you guys be down to write some music? And me and Papa Molly were like, dude, please. And so Bill was like, well, Robert Hunter has sent me a ton of lyrics. And I just have all these lyrics in my email and I don't know what to fucking do with them. I can't write music, you know? And we were like, are you serious? Like Robert Hunter, you know? And he was like, yeah, I've got probably close to 20 tunes, just in my email waiting. And so he forwarded me and Papa Molly the lyrics and it was like, I guess we're doing this, you know, And we got we went to a studio outside of Austin, for a week. And wrote the Seven Walkers album.
So you have this pack of Hunter lyrics, and now you're going to write music to him, knowing that it's Hunter and where his most of his creative outlet went. When you're writing that music, are you in any way, shape, or form, consciously or subconsciously, getting influenced at all by the Dead because you know that these are tunes written by the guy who writes the tunes, and you're playing them with Billy, a member of the Dead. So is the Dead's music coming into your mind at this point?
Yes, 100%. All I was doing was racking my brain to think of Grateful Dead sounding chord progressions or riffs. And whenever I would spit one of those out, Bill would go, nah, it sounds like the Dead. Right. And I was like, I love you. So basically like anything we did that sounded Dead-y, he would say, that's been done, man. We've done that. We did that. We did that 30 years ago. What are you doing? You know? So Bill kept it real honest, which, you know, thank God.
I want to jump now because Billy and the Kids leads to the Rhythm Devils, right?
No, other way around.
Rhythm Devils was first.
Rhythm Devils was first. Because of Kimok. Kimok was in the Rhythm Devils, and I think Porter was playing bass, and then Porter couldn't make some gigs. And funnily, and then I left the Seven Walkers after about a year and a half. Then Mickey hired me to be in Mickey Hart Band, which was pretty intense because we were on in-ears and playing to a click the whole time.
I want to go back to when you were playing with him and Billy at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, and I know that's two drummers, and I know for a little while in Tea Leaf you had two drummers as well. When you're playing with two drummers, or a drummer and a percussionist, as it sometimes is with Mickey, do you, as a bass player, or as you, the way you play bass, do you have to change your approach at all when you have two drummers on stage with you?
It depends on the people. To me, it's less about what instruments are on stage and more about what energies are on stage. You could have 20 drummers on stage if they're cooperating.
Right. That's a great answer.
If you have one drummer that isn't cooperating, it's impossible. So to me, it's really no different. I mean, the original Jacob Fred lineup was 8 people and included a percussionist and a drummer. So we always had two drummers up there until 2000.
I forgot that you had the two drummers back then. So you learned that situation early on.
Yeah. Playing with Bill and Mick, it was really interesting because I got to know Bill's playing pretty well before ever playing with the two of them. So I was really, really comfortable rhythmically with Bill before getting with the two of them. And the first thing I noticed when I was with the two of them was how much Bill loves Mickey as a brother. Bill started putting, it's hard to explain. He just smiled at Mickey a lot, and just like, I was just like, these guys fucking, these are brothers, man. These guys love each other. That's another thing that the Grateful Dead really taught me, especially those early 70s recordings, where it's just like the level of cooperation implies a type of acceptance of one another. I mean, self-acceptance, obviously, you have to have an extreme amount of self-acceptance to play improvised music at all, especially extremely improvised music where no one's vamping. Right. But the kind of playing that the Dead does, they're not only having to have an extreme level of self-acceptance, they're having to have an extreme level of acceptance of one another. I mean, any other band would have had a huge issue with what the other guys were playing. Dude, that keep the groove solid, or dude, the bass, keep the bass line going, or dude, the rhythm guitar is fucking, you're all up stepping on my toes, or like, dude, your solo takes forever, or like, god damn it, like you're out of tune, or
your left hand is too busy, get it out of my way.
Yeah, like there's just so much beef. Any other band would have been constantly at each other's throats. Don't play like that. Don't play like that. Don't play like that. And those guys encouraged each other and developed, they went further into their uniqueness rather than beating the uniqueness out of each other. They encouraged it and
it made it work
and made it fucking work. And then not only did they like it, hundreds of thousands of people danced and lived their lives by these songs and comforted themselves when they're grieving and put it on when they wanted to party and used this music for their whole lives. This music became almost like ritualistic, like a way to move yourself through the sorrows and joys of existing and being a fucking human. The beating heart of the Grateful Dead, the thing that everybody feels and is drawn to that you just can't fake or imitate.
I love your perspective on all of this, man. It's beautiful. It really is. And especially, for someone like we talked about earlier who came into learning about the Grateful Dead later, basically you're starting to learn about it when they're done, when the Dead is finished, in 95.
Completely.
And I love that someone who didn't necessarily get to see the Dead gets it this way and understands it this way and relates to it this way. And I want to thank you for sharing that with us. But before I let you go, I've been doing this with everybody. Mm-hmm. It hasn't always gone so fast, even though I'm calling it a lightning round. It doesn't always go fast. Try not to think. Just try to answer. You good?
Yes.
First of all, did you see the actual Grateful Dead? Did you get to see them?
I did not.
Okay. Do you have a favorite? Okay, we'll start here then. Favorite show?
I mean, I have five favorite shows.
Give me two of them.
I really like the Tampa 73 that was Dick's Picks Volume 1.
Yep.
It's got the best weather report suite I've ever heard. I really like the Winterland 74, the Farewell. I just, not only the playing, but the recording is outstanding. This doesn't count as a show, but Europe 72 as a live album is.
Okay. Well, that's the next one. Here. The next one is, well, first of all, you just answered two of them. Cause the next question, is studio recordings or live, and it's going to be live. Okay. And the next one, favorite Dead album. And we're going to go with Europe 72. Are we?
No. Blues for Allah. Blues for Allah. 100%. 100%. No question.
Favorite non-Grateful Dead album, any genre, what comes to mind?
Oh, I have no idea. I have no idea. I mean, name a year and I'll tell you my favorite album from that year.
I'll go with the year I was born, 1968.
1968. My favorite album from 1968 would be Nefertiti by Miles Davis.
There you go. Thank you.
Oh, wait, no. Electric Ladyland. Sorry. Electric Ladyland.
Favorite color?
Ooh. Blue?
First job
playing bass at the Spaghetti Warehouse in Tulsa.
Favorite venue to play?
Oh shit. Favorite venue to play. I mean, if it was what room have I played that I think is a most gorgeous room, it would be like Capitol Theater or Carnegie Hall, are both incredibly gorgeous rooms, but every time I've been in those rooms, I've been terrified. So, but the room I've had the most good experiences in would be Terrapin, hands down.
Nice.
I've played Terrapin Crossroads probably 150 times.
Best city for a day off.
Ooh.
I like that one.
New Orleans.
That's my answer too. First, but it can only be one day off, because if it turns into two or three, it can just get messy and ugly. 100%. I've had that happen three times. First car.
What was my first car? It was Jesus. I don't even remember. I remember what it smelled like.
All right. We'll move on to your current car.
Current car is a 2006 Prius.
Book you are reading?
Ooh, I am currently reading Dizzy Gillespie's autobiography.
Nice. I got to play with Dizzy one time. That's a whole other story.
No, you're not. What? What?
He told me I didn't know how to play the drums. I cannot thank you enough, my friend. This has been really, really amazing. Just to hear your perspective, and I love how it's attitude and spirit more than notes and roles. I think it's beautiful.
Well, thank you, man. I hope so. I've always looked up to you and Eaton and the crew, and you guys actually were one of my gateways to the Grateful Dead. I mean, I was watching y'all when I those could have been originals as far as I knew, you know.
Do you remember sitting in with us playing Dark Star?
Do I? Yeah, at Marvin's Mountaintop.
Yep. So we came out of space into Dark Star.
Hell yeah. The night that I will never forget was at the Gypsy Tea Room in Dallas. You guys just brought it so beautifully. I was spellbound.
Oh, thank you, man. Thank you. Well, hey, man, keep playing, keep working on it. I'm excited for your projects to come out. When this episode's coming out, we're going to let people know all about your new projects if you're ready. And stay safe and keep doing what you're doing, brother.
I will. I love you so much, and I can't wait to all be together again, dancing, grooving, doing it.
Right on, man. That's Reed Mathis, everybody. Thank you, pal.
Yeah, Kat.
So much fun. Reed is quite the bass player and quite the thinking man as well.
Well, that brings us to the end of our 10th episode, and I'd like to thank Reed Mathis and Joni Batari for spending some time with me today. I'd also like to thank my sponsors, Sarno Music Solutions and Blue Jade Audio, The Clean Store, The Authenticity Academy, and Grateful Sweats. If you enjoyed the show and would like to support the cause, please consider a subscription at patreon.com/themusicplays that offers weekly bonus content, or you can make a one-time contribution at paypal.me/themusicplays. Any love is much appreciated as we try and keep this show rolling along for another 10 episodes. The Music Plays the Band is produced by myself and the production and songwriting team Brothers Lazaroff here in St. Louis, Missouri. You can find out more about them at brotherslazaroff.com. The opening and segue music you are hearing are remixes of portions of DSO drum segments that are produced by my drumming partner Dino English. I'll be back again in 2 weeks on April 22nd with episode 11 with a very special guest, the legendary Jorma Kaukonen. Until then, stay safe, stay healthy, and please stay vigilant. We're starting to see that light at the end of the tunnel, and we're going to be able to hit the road in some capacity, but it's going to take everyone's efforts for us to get it back to normal as quickly as possible. Thank you all for being here. We'll see you next time.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.